I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Nina Lanza. She is a geologist working on the Curiosity Mars Rover Project. She's a postdoctoral research assistant at Los Alamos National Laboratory. And she will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock, giving a talk called A Year in the Life of the Curiosity Mars Rover at the O'Keefe Education Annex on Grant Avenue here in Santa Fe. It's sponsored by the Santa Fe Alliance for Science. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
So let's talk about the Mars rover Curiosity, but first let's kind of step back and talk about rovers in general. What is a rover?
Well, a rover is a spacecraft that we send to another planet that can actually move around. So that's in contrast to something like a lander, which would just stay in one place and do research, or an orbiter, which would be in orbit, a satellite around another planetary body. So what we have here is essentially a little car on the surface of Mars that we can drive around and do experiments with.
How are these rovers constructed to work under the different conditions of this planet, of Mars, like conditions of different gravity, atmosphere, geology, and so on?
I think probably the biggest one is the gravity. And I know that the engineers at JPL are very familiar with how to construct prototypes on the Earth that could that are essentially similar a weight and strength as they would be on Mars. So they're a little bit different on the Earth, but we understand that they can scale to Mars if we change certain parameters, like, again, sort of how big are they, what kind of materials are we using. So I think on Mars, Mars is actually a terrestrial-like planet. It's very much like Earth, so there aren't too many differences that we really need to make.
Except the gravity. I looked up one of those little calculators, and I would weigh 49 pounds on Mars.
Very slim.
So how are they powered, given the lack of gas stations on Mars?
Well, the rovers we've sent up previously have been powered differently than the current one that we've sent up. So in the past, we've had a combination of solar panels, very efficient solar panels, and also plutonium. The plutonium is actually in almost all spacecraft to actually keep it warm, because it's pretty cold in space. And it's still pretty cold on Mars, too. But this rover that we just sent up, Curiosity, is too large for solar panels. You know, the sun isn't very bright on Mars because Mars is further away from the sun. So because this is such a huge rover, it's the size of a Mini Cooper, this is all nuclear-powered. So we use plutonium to generate heat and electric power for the rover.
So then it can go around and do its thing day or night.
It can, although we have not done a lot of driving at night. The rover is somewhat autonomous, so it has its own cameras and it can avoid major hazards, but we really want to make sure we're there for it just in case it runs into trouble. So as of yet, we really don't drive at night. It also doesn't have headlights, unfortunately, so it would have a little bit of a harder time navigating.
So is there somebody sitting on Earth, you perhaps, or one of your colleagues, actually steering the rover around and looking at what it's looking at?
Yeah, so we don't do it in real time because Mars is far away, so there's actually a delay. And that delay depends on how far away we are from Mars at any given time. The shortest delay we would have is something like, 8-ish minutes, 10 minutes, and the longest delay could be on the order of an hour. So what we tend to do is we uplink, so we send to the rover, a series of commands that we want it to do. So say, hey, will you drive so far in this direction and then do an analysis on these rocks, or just do an analysis on these rocks and then drive. So in that way, we are not just constantly monitoring it. We send its commands while it's sleeping, and then we go to sleep, and the rover wakes up and looks at the plan and hopefully does that plan. And then at the end of the day, lets us know that it's done that, or let us know that it's, it hasn't done it, and why that is.
Does it have built-in safeguards that keep it from crashing into big things?
Yes, it does. So it does. It has a series of hazard cameras. Now, this rover can drive over things that are as large as 2 feet high. I mean, that's really big, but we don't want it to do that on its own. So usually, we will try to find it a path that is around large obstacles. It can also decide, it can say, hey, I think this is an obstacle you don't want me to drive around, and it can drive around it. But in general, yeah, I mean, it won't do anything, we hope, that will hurt itself. It won't let us do something like drive off a cliff.
Right.
That's right.
What is the nature of the communication of the transmission between Earth and the Mars rover?
Well, we're sending it essentially, you know, in sort of a radio frequency. It's a, you know, part of the electromagnetic frequency spectrum. We send it messages sometimes directly to the rover, but sometimes we also relay it through a series of satellites. So sometimes we can talk to a satellite. There are several orbiting Mars now. And that satellite can then talk to the rover, because sometimes the rover is on the other side of the planet and it's not facing Earth. We also have a series of, I guess, broadcasters across the Earth, so that we can always make sure that we can talk to the rover, or at least the satellites in contact with the rover at any time.
How many rovers have there been so far? How have they done? What have we learned from the successes and failures of each one in landing and building successful rovers and collecting data?
Yeah, that's a great question, because actually each rover has built upon the rovers of the past. So the first rover that we ever sent to Mars was as part of the Pathfinder mission in the mid-90s, and it had a little tiny rover called Sojourner, and it wasn't untethered from its little lander. It couldn't go very far, but it had a few instruments on it, and it showed us that we knew how to land on Mars and drive on there. So that was sort of that's why we called it Pathfinder. We were just finding our way. And the next rovers that we sent were the Spirit and Opportunity rovers in 2003. And one of them is actually still operating. It was only supposed to last for 90 days, each of them. And so it's been significantly longer than that. And those rovers really confirmed for us that there has been a lot of water on Mars. It's not as dry as it seems, and it's not as dry as it looks, even now. But there has been a lot of water soaking this planet. And so So based on those rovers, you know, we honed the questions we wanted to ask about water. And so now we've sent this enormous rover, Curiosity, which has a lot more instruments on it, including one that can really detect organic molecules. And part of why we chose to go to this location was based on what we found out from the previous rovers, particularly Spirit and Opportunity.
So the ability to detect organic molecules, does that indicate that there might have once been life? I mean, have you found any of these molecules?
Well, just to be fair, there are organic molecules even in space. So having organic molecules doesn't necessarily mean that there is or was life, but it opens up the possibility that life as we understand it could exist, because you need to have these organic molecules before you can have life. So those are the goal of Curiosity is to assess the habitability. And so habitability meaning what are the conditions, and are they conducive to life as we understand it? So that would mean there would be water there, there would be organic molecules, so things like that. Those are the main things that we're really looking for. So if we see organics, then the next step is what kind, and what do they say about life? So thus far we've found organic molecules, but none of them are, you know, like a smoking gun for life.
Is there any water there at this point?
Absolutely. There is a lot of water. In fact, one of the major results from the instrument that I work on, ChemCam, was that there's actually hydrogen in all of the dust. So hydrogen isn't something that likes to be alone. And hydrogen, generally speaking, likes to bond with oxygen. So that's water. Or hydroxyl, which is an O and an H. Another sort of water indicator. The very first shot we took with ChemCam on Mars, we saw a huge hydrogen peak. It was incredible, the very first shot, and it didn't end there. So every time we take shots with our instrument, we see water. So that's actually a lot more water than we ever thought that we'd see. I was surprised.
How much of Mars have the various Mars rovers actually taken a look at this point?
Very, very little. You know, Mars is a smaller planet than the Earth, but it doesn't have these major oceans, so its landmass, the surface area, is essentially the same as the exposed landmass on the Earth, right? So imagine trying to explore all the continents on Earth with four little rovers, you know. So you would know something about the Earth, but you wouldn't know everything, certainly. So we're really just scratching the surface, literally and figuratively.
We're talking to Nina Lanza about the Mars rover Curiosity. Now, you work on the ChemCam. What is that?
The ChemCam, this is an instrument which is short for chemistry and camera. So as you might imagine, we're a chemistry instrument that also has a camera. How it works is that we have a laser, which is pretty cool on Mars, if you think about it. We have a laser that ablates, so vaporizes material at a distance from the rover. So we don't have to drive up to the rover. We can shoot it with our laser up to 7 meters away, so it's about 23 feet, so pretty far. And so we vaporize material, just a little piece, just a little bit. You know, we're talking like, you know, maybe a millimeter in diameter, a little puff of material. And that ablated material will show a very bright light. And we can look at that light from back on the rover. And depending on the colors of light that we see, we can actually tell what the elements are that we're vaporizing. So what we get back, when we do a ChemCam analysis, we get back a spectrograph, so again, the color of light and how much at every color do we have. And we also get a high-resolution image of the surface, so we can actually see what the chemistry is related to in the rock. So we can analyze individual mineral grains, and we know which ones they are because we have a picture of it.
So what have you found from those analyses that might be interesting or relevant to us non-chemists here on Earth?
Oh, sure. Well, I think some of the biggest results, as I said before, was the discovery of hydrogen. You know, we've seen so much hydrogen. So Mars has a lot more, has had a lot more contact with water than we ever saw was possible. So that's one thing. We've also found some higher silica materials. So silica is like a mineral sort of like quartz. But silica is a building block of most minerals. So when you have a rock like a basalt, which we have in New Mexico, the sort of black lava rock, it's not that high in silica. But in the rocks we're seeing on Mars, it's actually far higher in silica. So this is actually something we're still working on. We're trying to figure out, what does that mean? It could mean two things. One is that we have a very different style of volcanism than we've ever seen on Mars. Or it could also be a product of the interaction with water. So you see sometimes these very silica-rich coatings on rocks in the desert. So that's a type of weathering product that we see on the Earth when we've seen a lot of water. So this high silica is a new result that could really be telling us a lot about the aqueous history of the planet.
What kind of visuals are you getting? I mean, you've got this camera, too, and so you're getting all kinds of landscapes of Mars.
Oh, yes. I mean, we have actually many cameras. I'm trying to think if I can. Maybe it's four in total, four camera instruments. So our camera, as part of ChemCam, is actually the highest resolution one. So we can take images, you know, at a focus of infinity, but we don't have a very large field of view. So we usually take images that are very up close so we can get really fine detailed images. But there's also some other cameras that, like the MassCam, which shows us these beautiful color panoramas. So we actually have just gorgeous pictures of the scenery from that camera as well.
Do you envision a point where there will be actual material, geological material, coming back from Mars?
I certainly hope so. Right now, the only material that we have from Mars are in the form of meteorites. So that's when there was a big meteorite hitting Mars, and a piece of Mars flew off from the impact and then eventually made its way to Earth. So we have something like 50-something of those that we know are from Mars, but that's the only samples we have. So there have been discussions for future rovers to do either sample caching, so that means we'll gather a lot of materials into a container and then have another spacecraft come and get it, or just to do something like a flyby scoop of some material. You know, you send a spacecraft there and you just skim some rocks up and send it back. So this is something that's in active discussion. Of course, it's going to be very complicated because, you know, it's hard enough to get a spacecraft to Mars. Getting it back is really hard as well. I think we can do it. We just have to invest the resources to do it.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
I mean, as you're talking, I can't help but thinking, like, what would happen if one of your Mars vehicles landed, dumped a bunch of bacteria into the water on Mars, wait a few million years, and see what evolves?
Yeah. So it's interesting you're saying that. So we actually, at NASA, there is an Office of Planetary Protection, and it's their job to think of these potential issues, because it would be really tragic if you know, right now we're trying to see, you know, could there have been life on Mars? And it would be tragic if we discovered life on Mars that we actually brought ourselves, you know.
Right.
So before we decide to seed the planet with terrestrial life, I think it's really important that we maintain, you know, spacecraft that are as sterile as possible. So that's what we do now. But of course, there's always a non-zero chance that there's going to be a little stowaway. Life is very tenacious, and you know, even though it doesn't seem likely that anything could live on that journey to Mars, which takes about 8 or 9 months, something absolutely could. So right now we're trying really hard not to seed Mars with terrestrial life, but we absolutely could do it. There are plenty of life forms on Earth now that would be very happy to live on Mars.
Really? Like what?
Well, there are a lot of microbes that are really good at living in extreme environments. You know, we have things living on hydrothermal vents in the deep oceans, so that's really high temperatures, really high pressures. We also have microbes living in rocks in Antarctica, where it's really, really cold, really, really dry. You know, there are all kinds of living creatures that would do very well in the type of environment that Mars presents. I mean, I would even go as far to say something like lichen might even do all right. It wouldn't be great, you know, but it would be fine. So that's why we have to be really careful not to bring those with us until we want to, if we ever want to.
Do any other countries have programs on Mars, rovers or whatever? Are we working alone on this, or are there other nations involved?
Not at all. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. So our instrument, ChemCam, is actually a collaboration between the U.S. and France. So half of our team is actually works for the French Space Agency. And we're not the only instrument. There's quite a bit of collaboration, international collaboration. So this is really, even though this is spearheaded by NASA, this is really an international effort.
What are the plans for future rovers?
So I think that we are planning, this is in the very early stages, but there is going to be, if all goes well, another rover that is planned for 2020. Which sounds far away, but is not that far away. So it's in the very beginning stages where I think NASA is defining the kind of science they'd like to do, and they will then solicit ideas for instruments. So stay tuned for that.
Now, besides hydrogen, which you've talked about, what have been your greatest surprises about the data that's come back from Mars?
Well, So one of the very first things that we saw right in our landing spot was this type of rock called a conglomerate. And a conglomerate is a kind of rock that is made up of other rocks. So it's basically a bunch of rocks that got glued together, and this usually happens in a stream bed. So you have water flowing and moving these pebbles around, and then minerals will precipitate from the water and then eventually cement it together to make a rock. And we found that on Mars. That was shocking, I think. No one has ever seen anything like that on the planet. And we always assume that Mars is just volcanic rock. It's just basalt, you know, because that's what we've seen. But it's actually a lot more diverse than that. And we've never seen that before. So for me, that was a real surprise. And I guess just in terms of our own data, you know, our instrument is operating so well. I worked with this with our actual flight model in the laboratory before we put it on the rover and sent it to Mars. And, you know, it took really good data then. But, you know, and usually when you launch something into space, it's not very good for your optical system, right? All your alignment, you're expecting it to get offset a little bit. But it apparently was great for ours because our data looks so good. It looks like, you know, somebody did fine adjustments on Mars for us. So that was actually a really big surprise, although that's not a scientific result, of course. I'm just really excited. Our data look really good.
Right. We're talking to Nina Lanza about the Mars rover Curiosity. How did you get interested in studying Mars?
So it started when I was a kid, definitely. My parents took me to an outreach event at a local university. I'm from the Boston area. And it was to see Halley's Comet. And before that time, I had never really thought about the sky as anything more than a dome. And it was then when I realized the sky is not a dome at all. It's this three-dimensional space, and there's all kinds of stuff in there, and we don't know a whole lot about that. And so that's really started my interest in space. And then, of course, Mars is just such a romantic planet in so many ways. You know, that's where Martians come from. There's a lot of science fiction stories written about Mars. And so I was a just about graduating from high school when we sent the Pathfinder rover to Mars, and I just knew I had to be involved somehow. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I needed to work on a Mars mission. So I spent the next many years of my life making that happen.
Do you think that people will at some point go to Mars?
I hope so. I say I hope because I think all it takes now is the will and the funding. You know, we can do this. We've been to the moon and back. Mars is different and presents its own challenges, but we can do this. We just have to decide if we're going to. So I really hope that in my lifetime I get to see that.
Would you like to go?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I guess I would want to make sure that maybe I'm a little bit older. I'm 34 right now, so, you know, maybe in 10 years when I'm ready to say, okay, maybe if I don't come back to Earth, that's okay. Right. I'd like to come back, but I don't think I'm quite done with Earth yet. But if I got the opportunity to go there, yes, absolutely. Because, you know, our instruments are incredible. We do incredible science with these rovers, but they just don't compare to a human geologist. I can do so much just by looking around. I can do so much analysis that our rovers, you know, as good as they are, they can't do that for us. And they can only get the data we ask them to get. And sometimes we take data and we finally analyze it and we're like, oh, we want to do another repeat. You know, we want to do another experiment, but we can't because we drove away. We can't drive back, you know. So I think as a geologist, I would just love the chance to do field work on another planet.
Nina Lanza is a geologist working on the Curiosity Mars Rover Project. She's a postdoctoral research assistant at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and she will be giving a talk tonight at 6 o'clock at the Georgia O'Keeffe Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue. It's sponsored by the Santa Fe Alliance for Science. It's a free event. Refreshments are served. Everybody is welcome. What will you be talking about, and will you be showing pictures?
Oh, absolutely. We have so many beautiful pictures, so I will definitely be showing those. I'll just be talking about what we've been doing in the last year. So we've been on Mars about one Earth year now, and over that time, we've seen so much and done so much science, and I hope that I can be able to give people a sense of what we've been doing and also to answer questions, because I know a lot of people see some of the pictures, you know, in the news, but there's not a lot of explanation, so I'm happy to provide some more background on whatever people want to know about.
Nina Lanza, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me. This was great.